Returning to today's meeting, the idea of this was really coalition. What did it mean in terms of international policy, and did it go wider to the parties that weren't in coalition? And the nickname for this meeting is the Three Tenors. One of them suggested to me the other day it might be more appropriate to call them the Three Fivers, but I leave that to you to judge at the end of this session. The first meeting we had was interesting because there was hardly a cigarette paper between all three speakers on all the issues that were talked about. Last year you began to see a little bit of movement between them. This year, particularly with Syria coming up fast over the horizon, I think we may see even greater divergence. But it's a great opportunity, which we very rarely have, to hear spokesmen for the three main parties talk briefly to us about their view of foreign policy, and then to open it up, as usual, to comments and questions at the end of their speaking period. So without more ado, I'm going to call them the opposite order to last year. I'm going to call Jack Straw first. Jack, I don't need to introduce, ex-Foreign Secretary, ex-Home Secretary, ex-Lord Chancellor, and very, very active still in the House of Commons. Ming Campbell, Sir Mingus Campbell, we congratulate you on your companionship of honour that was announced the other day. Is very well known and has been for a long time for his expertise on foreign affairs within the Liberal Democrats, was their spokesman and then their leader, and has been on the Foreign Affairs Select Committee for a long time, and is indeed on the Intelligence Committee at the moment, along with Malcolm, who chairs it, and myself. And the third speaker is Sir Malcolm Rifkind, also ex-Foreign Secretary, ex-Defence Secretary, speaking on the Conservatives' behalf. So I'm not going to say any more than that. I'm going to start by asking Jack Straw if he'll talk to us.
Thank you very much, Michael. This is, I see this as our opportunity from the luxury of the armchair marked critic to offer views on the coalition's foreign policy. And it will be recalled that the test, which I think was set by Hague in the speech in 2010, whether his foreign policy would be clear, focused and engaged. My answer to that after 3 years is that he succeeded, but in part. Dealing with those very briefly, I mean, I think that, first of all, the way that William Hague has protected the Foreign Office's budget, I mean, this is all relative, but he has protected it, and that is assisted by the fact that both the Prime Minister and the Chancellor used to work for him, always helps, I think. That's been impressive. We'll see whether that protection continues for... Do you want me to...
I need help at the back.
Okay. We'll see whether that protection continues after the 26th of June, when in 8 days' time we have George Osborne announcing the public spending plans for the next 3 years. But the five new embassies have been opened, and although for sure officials in the Foreign Office have felt the squeeze, it's not been as bad as in a number of departments. I welcome to the even closer relationship between the Foreign Office, its diplomats, and United Kingdom Trade and Investment, which we were getting going, I mean, but I think has been strengthened in the last 3 years. And I'm struck when I go around the world by the compliments that I receive around the world and indeed from constituents about the effectiveness of UKTI. And part of that is too is reflected in the renewed emphasis on Latin America, an important market, as well as more generally on the BRICS. In terms of concerns, I mean, there are plenty of areas of concern one could highlight. I want to highlight four. Three are in the same region: Syria, Iran, and the Middle East peace process, and then there is Europe. On Syria, I think that historians will say that the approach of the government to Syria has been characterised by a fair degree of uncertainty and false optimism. So, say, it's very easy to sit in the armchair and forget about what one was feeling about this 2 years ago. But, I mean, we're talking about government. There were wrong judgment calls made about how quickly this would be over, whether it would be over successfully. and a certain naivety which assumed that the demographic, political, religious makeup of Syria was similar to, say, Libya and Tunisia, or even Egypt, which plainly it is not. We are now stuck in Syria. There are those, and I respect them, on both sides, more on the conservative side than on our side, who believe that we should now be arming the rebels. I'm on the sceptical wing. I'm not saying we should never do that, but certainly not. But I'm sceptical about, so I wouldn't vote for it if there was a vote tomorrow, about what's the utility of arming the rebels now. And I know what the arguments are, and Malcolm, who's got a different view from me, will be able to express them. My concern is that you just end up in an escalation of the conflict rather than a reduction. I don't say this as any kind of apologist for the Russians, not at all, but this is my concern. On Iran, I've been co-chairman of the all-party group on Iran since 2010, and of course spent a great deal of my time as foreign secretary dealing with Iran, and I think by accident of history, not by as a result of any personal merit. I am the only British foreign secretary to have visited Iran. I've visited Tehran 5 times since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. I've taken a very close interest in it. I was on the same side, but supported the government when they decided they had to close the embassy in 2011 after its effective sacking. Not at the behest, I think, of the government, a formal government with capital G, but certainly at the behest of some private enterprise, probably by the Revolutionary Guards and the besiegers. I have, however, been concerned, so have a number of conservative, liberal, democrat colleagues, that there was not an effort more effectively to engage with the Iranians, but simply to up the sanctions and also to continue to mouth these threats of indeterminate military action if the Iranians did X or Y. These have been going on. It's part of Netanyahu's rhetoric for at least the last 10 years. They've been predicting that Iran was about to get a nuclear weapon in the next 6 months or 9 months or a year. They never have, and my own belief is that the Iranians are not planning, are not currently building a nuclear weapon system. They may well be trying to acquire the intellectual capability so they've got an option, as, say, Japan and Brazil has, which arises from a civil nuclear program. But I'm in the same position as the United States intelligence agencies, who said that in 2007 they've never changed this view, that the Iranians had, by that stage, abandoned their plans for any kind of nuclear weapon system. The election of Hassan Rouhani is of major importance. It's an opportunity for the West, for the E3+3, to break down those barriers, to normalise relations with Iran, and as a result of this, to help to open up Iranian society. It requires care, however. I mean, I said in the House of Commons yesterday, when I got an urgent question to Mr. Haig, that we should not expect too much too soon from Mr. Rouhani. He doesn't take office until August the 3rd. He won't form a government for another month. He's got to negotiate with the Supreme Leader, the Revolutionary Guards, the Parliament, which can reject his own ministers, and much else besides. So he's in a complicated situation. But nor should we follow what the Israeli hard-right neocon view, which was well illustrated by a piece in yesterday's FT by Martin Indyke, who's basically saying we shouldn't give them anything. Well, that's a way to ensure that Rouhani and the Iranians have pushed back. As I say, it's a really important opportunity. It requires a very good diplomacy, a building up of relations privately, a lot of track two work, a lot of confidential meetings and confidence building measures of a sort of classic kind before the formal negotiations. Middle East, the government, in my view, has had a better rhetoric and a more balanced rhetoric on Middle East as between Israel and Palestine, be very condemnatory of the takeover, the theft of Palestinian land by the Israelis, but I don't get much sense of activity from them. Last issue is Europe, in my two more minutes, and it's on Europe that the coalition, or particularly, frankly, the Conservative Party, is at its least coherent, in my view, most dangerous. I, for those of you who haven't seen it, I commend an excellent speech called Britain and the EU, an ever closer union of peoples, at the London School of Economics on the 2nd of May this year, by Sir Malcolm Rifkind, MP. Well, harm his Eurosceptical credentials, because he makes clear that he has none, apart from a throwaway line saying we're all Eurosceptics. Now, scarcely a word in that that I disagree with. The problem for Malcolm and for others is that Mr. Cameron, and to a degree Mr. Hague, have allowed the Eurosceptics in their party, whose appetite is insatiable, or will only be satiated when Britain leaves the European Union, to dictate both the tactics and the strategy. So we've now got, in a couple of weeks' time, a ludicrous position where there's a private member's bill by a rookie backbench Tory MP, who I've not heard of, proposing a timetable for a referendum in 2017. This is really dangerous stuff. I was a member of the No campaign in 1975, and I thought it was perfectly coherent to vote No at that stage. I've always been, what I've said, as a practical European, but I do not believe that our interests lie outside the European Union now. In fact, I'm quite clear that they don't. And Malcolm mentions things like the Working Time Directive, that should come out of the negotiations. Well, the Working Time Directive is ridiculous. If we change it, as he says, it's not going to, or come out of it, it's not going to affect how doctors are employed in France or Germany or anywhere else. It should never have been thought of. We ought to deal with it. But it should not be the occasion for leaving the European Union, for us then, I think, isolating ourselves and reducing our influence in the world. And my worry is that although Mr. Cameron and Mr. Hague don't want this, their infelicitous tactics and strategy could end up in a situation where they go into negotiations or force us, when we come into government, force us to do the same with a referendum at the end of it, and where the appetite of the Eurosceptics and the newspapers behind them is bound to say, we don't like this, we're not satisfied, because they are unsatisfied about the fact we're in, and the result of that, and it would be a catastrophe for Britain, as well as representing neither a clear, focused, nor engaged foreign policy, if we were to leave. Thank you very much. Well done.
Thank you very much, Jack, and absolutely on time, so it's great.
I'd like to begin by removing what might be a false impression in your minds. We were described as the three fivers. Any contribution you make to the GSF will not be received in any form by us. That may make us the 3-0, rather than either the three musketeers or those of a certain age, and who know Hollywood, the three Stooges. It's interesting that Michael has imposed a reverse order this year. Funnily enough, I'm almost second.
Typical liberal.
Well, you remember Avis made a great deal of money by arguing firmly that they were just as good as Hertz, although they weren't quite so big. I've just committed a terrible solecism in the House of Commons. We've had Foreign Office questions, and William Hague was dealing with the issue of Syria, and I got up and I asked him a question, the conclusion of which was to say, and can he assure us that his government, and I paused and said, I'm sorry, our government, is doing everything it can to deal with the humanitarian issue. There was a bit of back chat. Mr. Dennis Skinner felt it was necessary to interfere, or intervene, more correctly. Look, this is a coalition. I have the luxury of independent thought, and there are three elements of foreign policy with which I disagree with the Prime Minister. And the first is one to which I made reference, I think, last year, and it's the issue of defence, because, of course, defence is the means by which you implement many of your foreign policy objectives. 5,000 redundancy notices have gone out to members of the British Army today. We're engaged in going from 98,000 to 82,000 to be supplemented by 30,000 reservists. The large question mark as to whether or not we'll ever receive 30,000. Now, you can argue that you need smaller numbers because the ships are cleverer. The aircraft, like for example the Typhoon, is fly-by-wire. It only requires one aircrew rather than two. A frigate used to require 250 men and women to man it. Now you can do it with 160. Of course there are improvements because of technical advance. But the truth is that you can't reduce in substantial numbers unless you accept that there's going to be an effect on capability. Now you can have an army that consists of one regiment, of one ship and one aircraft, rather like, if I may be permitted a partisan point, the Scottish National Party seem to be promising Scotland if the referendum is answered in the affirmative. You can have a militia. But the point is this, that if you reduce your capability, then you reduce your foreign policy choices. And in particular, the issue which causes a great deal of difficulty is that of resilience. You can go and do something for 6 weeks, but if it takes 6 months, then it imposes enormous strains. And that's why, slightly to his surprise, I've been supporting Philip Hammond in his efforts to persuade the Treasury, not a penny more. Now, on Europe, we've already heard from Jack. I had a rare distinction on the Queen's Speech debate in voting for the Prime Minister in order to protect him from his own party. In 26 years in the House of Commons, it's the first time I've ever been obliged to do that. Look, there's no question that we are united, pretty well all of us, in support of the case for reform. And Jack has already mentioned the Working Time Directive. I met recently the President of the Royal College of Surgeons. And you would imagine the President of the Royal College of Surgeons would be concerned to ensure that standards of performance were properly maintained, that there were no mistakes. But his response to the Working Time Directive is to say the way in which it has been imposed and the way in which it's implemented means that many young doctors do not achieve the breadth of experience which is essential if you're going to be able to cope with emergencies. And there's another issue which is that of the European arrest warrant. Polish courts will give a European arrest warrant for the theft of a wheelbarrow. Some of the conditions to which we send those who are taken in by the European arrest warrant are frankly unacceptable. The position of women prisoners, for example, in Greece is dire. And so, is there need for reform? Of course there is. Recognising, as the Association of Chief Police Officers do, that the European arrest warrant is a very, very valuable tool in the maintenance of law and order. Any referendum, whenever it's called, will be on in or out. Be in no doubt about that. That's how it will be characterised on both sides. And the point I would make really in support of Jack is this. The Prime Minister has made and will continue to make concessions. Let me remind the historians among you about the lesson of Danegeld. The Danes were paid to go away. They went away for a short time, but they came back. They always asked for more geld. And if on an issue of this importance you have to make concessions to those sitting behind you, then it's inevitable that they will not so much smell blood, but taste blood. And their demands will increase. And that's why, as I think Jack has already said, it's quite extraordinary the governments can support a private member's bill in a fortnight or 3 weeks, which is actually contrary to, well, I should say, the Conservative part of the government is going to support the private members, which is actually contrary to their own avowed policy. Let me turn quickly to Syria. The one thing you can be certain is that the umbilical cord between Russia and Syria will not be broken for a lack of arms supplies. And so long as Assad has the assurance of unqualified Russian support and the supply of arms that goes with that support, then getting him to change his position is virtually impossible. Unless you could persuade the Russians to exercise the kind of influence over him they exercised over Milosevic, many years ago now in relation to Kosovo. What did for Milosevic, not 88 days of NATO bombing, what did for him was the Russian foreign minister arrived in his office and said, we will not support you if the alliance puts troops on the ground in Kosovo. You have to persuade the Russians. You will not, in my view, persuade the Russians by upping the ante, by offering weapons to the so-called rebels. Three questions. What weapons would you send? To whom would you send them? And to what effect? Let me deal with these three very briefly. The kind of weaponry which John McCain's arguing for is highly sophisticated. You don't just turn up with a, what used to be called a Stinger, SAM-7, surface-to-air missile and fire it. You need to be trained. How can you be trained? You can only be trained if technicians, either military or civilian, go and do so. How do you identify the good guys rather than the bad guys? And let's be clear, the so vociferous is the opposition in Syria that it's very difficult sometimes to tell the good from the bad, but often it's very clear as to who are the bad. And just remember the lesson of Afghanistan. The United States flooded Afghanistan with weapons in an effort to support the resistance to the Soviet Union when it invaded. And when the United States went back to Afghanistan, some of the weapons that were used against it were the very weapons which it had supplied. Assad, will he change course? Where is the evidence that by sending weapons to the rebels, we will persuade Assad to change course? I know of no such evidence. That's why a moment or two ago I referred to the importance of ensuring that you create, so far as you possibly can, and the Geneva Conference may be a first rather tentative step towards this, but you create, so far as you possibly can, an impetus led by the Russians to persuade Assad to change course. There are no good, easy decisions in relation to Syria, but I venture to suggest the proposal that we should send arms to the rebels is one of the worst.
Thank you very much, Ming, and I'm going to call on Malcolm Rifkind.
Ladies and gentlemen, when you actually are Foreign Secretary, you have to be very careful about what you say. Harold Macmillan once said that foreign ministers, when they speak, they're in a cruel dilemma. Their speeches, he said, hover between a cliché and an indiscretion. And he went on to say they're either dull or dangerous. One of the joys of not being Foreign Secretary is that these considerations don't apply. We can be dull and dangerous, or either, as the mood takes us. In the time available, I'm going to concentrate just on 2 points, on Europe and on Syria. And I have a few thoughts that I would like to share with you. Europe, and I'm most grateful to Jack, not only for having read my lecture to the LSE, but actually praising it, commending it, and encouraging you all to read it as well. So that's rare praise indeed. Europe can sometimes seem a very solemn and a very ghastly subject, a very boring subject. Just occasionally, there is something that lights up your day. And my most memorable experience when I had to attend the Council of Ministers was in the 1980s, when I was Minister of State, the Europe Minister, attending a meeting in Brussels discussing enlargement of the EU. And the question at the time was whether Spain and Portugal could join the EU. And the Greek minister, Mr. Haralambopoulos, was making an impassioned speech entirely in Greek. And at one stage, the interpreter, translating him into English, quoted him as using the phrase, putting a Spaniard in the works. Total collapse of all the English speakers, and the Greek minister to this day doesn't know what he said to cause that effect. Now, the issue, and Ming and Jack both raised it quite properly, is the government's, or the conservative part of the government's policy on Europe and the question of a negotiation or renegotiation leading to a referendum. I have to say to you, I am actually genuinely more optimistic about that prospect. And indeed, I think it is not an unreasonable thing to be doing. And handled in the right way, it can lead to very important and desirable consequences, both for Britain and for Europe as a whole. The starting question has to be, does Britain, at the end of the day, if the conditions are okay, wish to remain in Europe? And do the other 26 member states want Britain to remain? If the answer to both these questions, with all the necessary caveats, is yes, then that itself is quite a substantial leap forward. When people are involved in a negotiation and they're looking for the answer yes, they quite often find it. When either or both of them are looking for the answer no, then that's when the negotiations collapse unsuccessfully. So in terms of the timing of these negotiations, there's a very fortunate coincidence. For obvious reasons, David Cameron doesn't want to start this negotiation until after the next election. But of course, all the other European states are preoccupied quite properly with the Eurozone crisis and what flows from that. So the last thing they would want is to have an immediate address of this matter. Secondly, when we look at the overall thrust of what Mr. Cameron and the Conservative Party is seeking to achieve, it is essentially to have a Europe that the people of the United Kingdom are comfortable in being part of and will vote to remain in. And that essentially means a diverse Europe. It doesn't mean a two-speed Europe, which is a phrase you often hear being made. Because a two-speed Europe implies you may be going at different speeds, but you all end up at the same place. And in the case of Europe, that would mean the same level of integration. And that's not going to happen. Certainly not for the United Kingdom, probably not for Sweden or Denmark, and quite likely for a number of other countries as well. So it's not two-speed Europe, it's two-tier Europe, or some other similar phrase. It's a differential kind of membership, what's often called variable geometry, or Europe à la carte. Now, some may say, well, actually, haven't you got that already? And the answer is yes, we do. In the sense that we have an opt-out from the single currency. We're not part of Schengen. We have a choice as to whether we link up with Justice and Home Affairs, and so forth. However, the problem at the moment, and it's a fundamental issue which has to be addressed, it's not just the Working Time Directive, forgive me. It is that each time the European Union looks at some proposed new area of harmonisation, yes, you can get opt-outs, but only after a massive battle and an enormous amount of discontent with the problem never resolved. And given that the United Kingdom will now require a referendum before it could go ahead with any further sharing of sovereignty, what happens if the people of Britain vote no? And the whole of the EU is prevented from moving to one new area of integration because one country, well, we've seen what happens. There's another crisis. And when it's a small country like Ireland or Denmark, they get bullied. But in the case of the United Kingdom, that simply wouldn't be deliverable. So the current arrangements do not avoid crisis. They guarantee its continuation. What you need is a new relationship in the EU where those countries who wish to go forward to greater integration are entitled to do so. We can't veto them. Others can't veto them. But equally, those countries that don't, they have an equal reciprocal right to say, on this area, you go forward if you wish to, but we choose not to. And that's not something that needs to be negotiated in bad feeling and late into the night. It is something which creates a diverse Europe. And what's wrong with that? Because, of course, we have it already. Half the EU isn't even in the Eurozone, and that hasn't brought the European Union to a halt, nor will it, despite the fact that that will remain the facts for many years to come. So I think if David Cameron, if he's Prime Minister, if this negotiation begins, he has to recognise there has to be compromise. He has to recognise the most successful negotiation doesn't mean you get 100% of what you wish and the other side gets nothing. But what he has to also do is be quite clear as to what is our bottom line. Margaret Thatcher had a much more difficult problem when she was negotiating the EU rebate. Every pound that she won had to be paid for by other countries. How do they justify that to their partners? If David Cameron is able to say, these are a range of areas, like the Working Time Directive, where we can get what we want, which won't harm anybody else, then I believe if there is a general desire to see United Kingdom remaining in the EU, we will get the right result, and that is, I think, worth aiming for. Let me quickly then turn to the other main issue, obviously Syria. And, you know, I just want to make 3 points to you about the specific question of arms sales, or arms provision, not sales, providing arms to the Syrian opposition. First of all, I say opposition, not rebels. We have recognised the Syrian National Coalition as the legitimate representatives of the Syrian people. Not just we, not just the United States and the European Union, 100 members of the United Nations, including virtually all the Arab states, have recognised them and have said it's Assad who's no longer legitimate. So that's a starting point worth thinking about. Secondly, I wish those who attack the policy, they're perfectly entitled to attack the policy of providing arms. It's a difficult issue. It's a sensitive issue. But it's quite extraordinary that they don't bear in mind that the arguments that they constantly use about the difficulties of providing arms, they make these points as if President Obama or David Cameron or François Hollande haven't taken that into account. I mean, this is an American president who has been trying to stay out of Syria for the last 2 or 3 years. But the logic of events have forced him to come to a view, well, despite all that I wanted to do, maybe I do have to consider providing military help to the Syrian opposition. David Cameron, François Hollande, Britain and France were part supporters of the embargo. As we've been told, it's only very slowly and very reluctantly they've come round to that view. People might like to ask, why do these three international leaders, why are they doing this? They're not responding to populist demands from their own country in order to win votes. It's the other way around. It's an unpopular policy. When governments do things that are unpopular, that perhaps should require more thought than when they're doing things that are just hoping for more votes. So I make that point because when I get people, including some of my own colleagues, like Boris Johnson, talking about providing arms to maniacs, as if somehow that's what somebody suggested, it is a pretty silly and pretty... I think you should stick to London. It's much more... much more encouraging. Two other points, briefly, because I'm conscious of time. The first is, well, what are to be the benefits of providing military support? There's one overwhelming benefit. And I simply pose this question to you. At the moment, what possible incentive does Assad have to go and negotiate a compromise towards some coalition or some transitional government that will enable this crisis to be resolved? When he's receiving arms from the Russians and from the Iranians, and how hypocritical can you get when you hear the Russians criticizing possible arms provision to the opposition when they are at this very moment admitting they're providing arms themselves to the Assad regime, which has helped slaughter up to 93,000 Syrian men, women and children. So if Assad knows that he gets the arms, but the Syrian opposition don't, why should he compromise? Why should he leave? When he's indifferent to the slaughter he's responsible for, why should he change that track? But if the Syrian opposition, who can't be defeated by him, but who equally cannot defeat him, if they, over a period of time, increase their military capability, that changes the balance and makes the need for a negotiated settlement recognized not just in the rest of the world, but in Assad's own bunker as well. Finally, the question of how do you stop the arms getting to the wrong people? You know, it's worth remembering that the number of the size of the Syrian opposition forces is estimated as about 100,000. The highest estimate that has been I've seen of the size of Jamaat al-Nusra, that's the al-Qaeda people, the bad guys, as they can be described, is about 5,000. They are not part of the Syrian National Coalition. They're not allies of the main opposition. Quite the opposite. They're sworn enemies. And the idea that if in a controlled way we provide military equipment to the Syrian National Coalition, 95,000 of the 100,000 opposition forces, that if we provide our military equipment to them, who are starved of those weapons, that they are somehow going to hand them over to al-Qaeda, who not only already have them, but who are their sworn enemies, I just don't find that terribly convincing. I'm not saying that the odd weapon might not end up with them. That's true in any situation. The Jamaat al-Nusra, al-Qaeda people, are using Syrian army weapons that they've captured, so of course that can happen. But the idea that somehow this is a massive risk which is likely to happen, flies in the face of the reality. So I'm conscious of time. I conclude by simply saying that occasionally in this imperfect world, you have to reluctantly come to the view that what might otherwise be a bad decision is worse than the status quo, which is even worse. You know, is better than the status quo, which is even worse. And that is, I think, the situation we're in at the moment. And I think it requires not just a simple dismissive, oh, it'll all end up in the hands of terrorists. It is, how do you actually get a negotiated settlement? And that means, how do you get Assad to the negotiating table? And if the President of the United States, the British Prime Minister, the French Prime Minister, have changed their position in a way that creates huge problems for them at home, at least give them the credit for having thought this through, having got advice to this effect, having looked at all the implications, and having come to the judgment that the position they've either adopted or are moving towards is certainly better than doing nothing. Thank you.
wonderful if you signal me that you want to come in to give your name, and if you represent anybody, to tell us who it is and keep your questions and your remarks short. Can I just ask the panel generally, before we start, whether they think that if there is a vote on this issue of arms to the Syrian opposition, in the House of Commons at least, whether there is any chance of it getting a majority? Do you want to try that, Malcolm?
Well, I think at this moment in time, probably no. The answer would be there wouldn't be, but that's not how it's going to be handled, I don't think. I think this is a process of gradually explaining the considerations. I was very interested in the way Jack put his own position. He said at the moment, I think you said you'd be inclined to vote against,
yep,
but that you didn't have a closed mind on the
subject.
No, that is, I think, the position of a large number of MPs. There will be many, I don't know Ming's position, but there will be many who say, I cannot be persuaded. But there will be equally many who know that doing nothing, or I'm being a bit unfair perhaps in saying doing nothing, but just hoping that negotiations will happen is not a very attractive alternative.
Ming?
I think we're bound to have a vote. William Hague reaffirmed that only an hour or so ago. Prime Minister did certain Prime Minister's questions last week, and of course you remember that we had a vote in relation to the military action against Iraq, and then we had a vote in relation to the action against Gaddafi. And these, although the Parliament can never bind itself, these will be persuasive political precedents which the government will have to follow in this case, I believe. At the moment, I don't think there is a majority. Whether there would be a majority in the future would depend to a very large extent upon the Labour Party. If the Labour Party collectively was to say no, then I think there are sufficient number of Liberal Democrats and sufficient number of members of the Conservative Party on the back benches who would also say no, and the government's policy in that respect would be defeated.
Jack?
Yeah, if there was a vote tomorrow, it would be defeated by quite a margin. Because the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats, almost to a person, would vote against. And so there's a significant minority on the Conservative benches. If down the track, say there is a Geneva II conference, and it fails, and it fails very obviously because of Russian and Assad regime intransigence, then I think the circumstances change. And it is probable, I don't speak for Douglas Alexander or Ed Miliband, it is probable that the Labour Party's view would change in those circumstances.